You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
What does motion sound like? With Kizikans free shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters. Both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Hey everyone, I just wanted to give you all a quick warning. I was unable to record this week's episode with my microphone. I unfortunately was traveling this week and did not have my microphone, and so I had my AirPods and my computer, so the quality is not the greatest. I just wanted to let you all know in advance and apologize for any trouble that it may present, but you should be able to understand it all, and you should enjoy it, and most importantly, you will understand our guest, so yeah. It'll be great, and it'll be a great episode, and I can't wait for you all to listen, so thanks again.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 118 of Take a Bow. I'm your host, Eli Tokash, and this week we have such an exciting episode for all of you. Incredible guest this week, actually. I'm very happy that we were able to chat with him. It's someone that I've actually been trying to get on for quite some time. He has been casted in 9 Broadway shows, and unfortunately, we didn't even get to talk about all of them because we didn't have enough time. I feel like I'm always running out of time with these guests because I kind of just get lost in conversation with them. But it was such a great interview nonetheless, and he's doing so many things. He's doing all the TV stuff. He's currently filming a TV show, a season 3 of an HBO Max show that we talk about. And then he's done movies. He's done producing. He's directing. He's performing on all these things. It's none other than Telly Leung, who is an inspiration to all of Broadway performers, fans, everything in between. He is unbelievable, and our chat is just so, so fun, and I can't wait to bring it all to you. So before we do that, we got to talk about some Broadway news, because there's been a lot, I mean, not a lot, but there's been some things to mention that is definitely worth talking about. I do want to start off, unfortunately, I hate to start off with sad news, but we did get the sad news that Broadway performer and MCC founding co-artistic director Bob Lapone passed away this past week following a 3-year battle of pancreatic cancer. For those of you who don't know, Robert Lapone is Patti Lapone's older brother, and he's been in a million Broadway shows, literally, whether like performing, producing, all the things. He's done so much for this community and is a big, big name and light in this community. And it's so sad to hear that he passed away. MCC, he's the co-artistic director there, and that was the theater that last week's guest, Samantha Polino, is currently about to open a brand new show in, Only Gold. So very sad to hear. My heart and thoughts and prayers, all the things, go out to the Lapone family. And yeah, just so sad to hear. Cancer, it's the worst. Anyways, now for some more positive news. The New York Post came out and said, this is, like, interesting because right now there's, like, no actual announcement and the Schubert Theater is still vacant. But the New York Post said that Alec Baldwin is going to be returning to Broadway and going to be in a brand new show called Art. And it's reportedly playing at the Schubert Theater. But, again, there's been no announcement. So I guess it's far in the process, but it's nothing official yet. So I will keep you all posted on that. Again, these Broadway news that are breaking with these rumors, it's driving me crazy. Anyways, that's happening. I'm excited because, I mean, it's Alec Baldwin. I've worked with him before. He's a brilliant guy, a brilliant talent, and I'm interested to see how he would do on Broadway. And I think that his name alone will get a lot of people into Broadway and into a Broadway theater, just growing our community, which would be lovely. This cast is actually going to be stacked, so it's not just Alec Baldwin. There's going to be some other stars in the show, too. So very exciting stuff there. Moving on, Okay, this isn't like the most interesting thing for a Broadway fan, but to a Broadway performer, this is definitely something worth noting. The Music Man held a benefit performance for the Entertainment Community Fund, and it gave a special performance on August 28th that was kind of dedicated for Broadway performers, and it was like a show that was only happening during that time. Like, there was only that show happening. It wasn't like it was a regular Broadway scheduled show where it's like a 2 and 8 on a Saturday or whatever. It didn't like conflict with the other schedule. So for those performing on Broadway right now, they were able to go see the show. And if anyone saw photos of the show and of like the weekend, you saw that Andrew Keenan Bolger was there. You saw that Eva Noblezada and Reeve Carney was there. You saw that Bernadette Peter and Joel Grey was there. You saw all of these incredible Broadway people. And that's because they were able to hold this benefit performance where, you know, they allowed the people within the Broadway community go see the show at a time that does not conflict with their schedule. So very exciting stuff. Shout out to Music Man. I wish that more shows would do this. Unfortunately, those shows aren't usually open to the public, and it's more of like an invite-only type thing. But it's definitely worth noting, and hopefully more shows do the same, because I've talked to like Telly Leon, right? And we didn't get to Aladdin, but I mean, it was Aladdin. Like, we had to talk about it. He's the longest running Aladdin on Broadway, but unfortunately we didn't get to it. But we've had conversation with people that played Aladdin before. We talked to Adam Jacob and everything. So if you're interested in Aladdin talk, you can go listen to those episodes. But unfortunately, like during the episode today, I was like, oh, I didn't get to see that show because I was in like Neverland or Pippin. And, you know, it was because they didn't have opportunities like this where you could like have a special performance for the other shows on Broadway so that they can consume theater as well after performing each shows a week. So anyways, I thought it was worth noting. I thought it was so cool to see all of those stars in the same room and something worth noting. So now I'm going to end this little segment on some Broadway, like, I guess like tea or like gossip. I don't know. But it involves Funny Girl. And I know that interests you all already, because there's already a bunch of tea with the Lea Michele going in next week, which is crazy that she's going into the show next week. And she was told by the producers that a legendary song of the show, My Man, is going to be put back into the show for her run. Well, now they tested it out on Julie Benko. And they tested it out in the show because it wasn't in the show for Beanie. It's this long song. The show is already long. And so this song, like, literally makes the first act an hour and 45 minutes, which is so long. So they were testing it out. The producers apparently, like, now they're saying, like, they're going back and forth on it. After promising Lea that she was going to be able to perform it and they were going to put it back in the show with her, they were going to write it back in, they were going to write a scene, they were going to write the song, all of the things, they were going to make it work. Well, now they're like, oh, maybe we should have put it in. I don't know if it works, all of these things. And so there's some diva-ness going on from Lea Michele, where she's like kind of upset, and rightfully so. Like, she was promised something that, you know, she now may not get. And it's crazy to hear. It's crazy because, like, it's like, you know, you're in a Broadway show, you're going to be fine. Perform Don't Rain on My Parade and just, like, sing your heart out. But, yeah, so I just thought that was worth noting. Keep an eye on the Funny Girl news, because there's always some things going on with that show, and it's always entertaining, and it's always tea. So check it out. But, yeah. Apparently, like, it wasn't, like, anything against Julie Benko of, like, her performance of the song, and she's excited that she was going to be able to sing it because it was in the original, but they didn't write it in for the revival. But, yeah, now they're saying, like, oh, they don't know if it's going to work. And Lea Michele is like, oh, no, why now? Because I was told that I was going to be able to perform it. But, yeah, anyways, that's what's going on, and thought it was interesting. So that's all the news I have for you folks this week, with a little bit of gossip. So without further ado, I think it's time to turn it over to Telly Leung, because we have a great chat, a wonderful, wonderful chat, and you can learn so many things in this interview. So I'm just going to turn it over to him. So without further ado, Telly Leung, curtain up. this week's guest has one of the most well-rounded resumes in the entire entertainment industry. From performer to director to producer, I mean, you name it. He has 20 years of experience performing on Broadway. He's been casted in 9 Broadway shows. Everyone, join me in welcoming to Take a Bow, Kelly Leung.
Hi, Kelly. I'm good. Hi, how are you?
I'm so well. Thank you so much for doing this. I'm so excited.
I'm thrilled to be here.
Yeah, so the way I usually like to start these fun episodes is by asking each guest, I guess, that I have on, what kind of inspired you to tell stories and kind of get in the entertainment industry and be a performer?
Yeah, I think I always loved theater, and I always say I think I blame Julie Andrews for my love of musicals, because it was always Sound of Music and Mary Poppins that was showing during the, you know, during the holiday season for free on TV. And so I sort of blame Julie Andrews in a lot of ways, but I don't know if I actually thought that this was something that I could do for a living until I sort of saw people that looked like me, like, win Tony Awards. You know, like, I remember watching the Tony Awards and watching Lea Salonga win a Tony, and that, I don't know if even at that age I thought, oh, that's what I want to do, but I think that was certainly the first inkling of going, oh, that's somebody who looks like me, who is doing this, who has now just won a Tony Award. So, you know, I think that probably made a huge difference. I don't think I would know the significance of that till much later, till I got older. But yeah, I think that was sort of the first time that I was sort of like, oh gosh, like, this is an actual thing I can do. And of course, then, you know, seeing Miss Saigon, I think, was a big deal for me, because it was a cast full of Asian people. That was something that I had not seen in Broadway shows. In my first couple of Broadway shows that I saw Cats. That was my first Broadway show. But, like, somebody's a cat, so, like, you can't really tell who's under all that cat makeup, right? And then I saw Crazy for You, and Crazy for You, there, I think there was, like, one person of color on stage.
Oh, yeah.
So I just, you know, I in my brain, I just thought, oh, there's probably not a place for me. This isn't something that's for people who look and sound like me. And then it was really seeing Miss Saigon and also seeing Rent, where I sort of saw, like, the diversity of the city that I grew up in. I grew up in New York, and it was the first time that I looked up at a Broadway stage and I said, oh, that looks like my home. That looks like where I grew up. That looks like New York, and I'm a New Yorker, so maybe I can do this. And that was right around, like, the original cast of Rent came out when I was in high school. So really, like, those very impressionable high school years of, like, doing High School Musical theater, cutting class to go buy the double disc CD of the Rent cast recording. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, that, it was a very impressionable time. So, for sure, like, I think probably those were the contributing factors.
And was it, like, always, like, musical theater? Was it kind of like, oh, TV and film could possibly be a thing? Because I know you dabble in that, too.
I do. You know, it's interesting. I it's weird. Whenever I do TV and film, and I'm right now in, I'm talking to you in Cape Town while I'm shooting a TV show for HBO. What's so wild is I always feel like a theater person. Mm-hmm. I think it's because that was my first love, was musicals. Yeah. You know, ever since seeing Cats, but also really, like, seeing Into the Woods on Great Performances. You know, seeing, being a Rent head, and, like, seeing Rent a bazillion times the summer of '97 when, like, I would, like, sleep on 41st Street at 5 in the morning to get a top ticket. You know, like, I mean, I was that kid. I was that kid that, like, slept outside for my $20 ticket and waited for the box office to open at 10 a.m., you know? So I feel like a theater person at heart. And even when I'm here, like, now working on a TV show, I have slight imposter syndrome sometimes of, like, am I really, do I do this? And of course you're like, yes, I've been hired to do this. I get hired to do this. Like, this is what I do. But as a little kid, I don't think I ever went, oh, I want to be on TV. That wasn't a thing for me. And it really wasn't until adulthood when they go, okay, well, Kelly, you're not always going to be singing and dancing and on Broadway. Like, you have to find other ways to make a living. Other, you know, when your Broadway show opens and closes, like, what do you do? Sometimes there isn't another Broadway show waiting for you. Most often there is not, actually. So you have to find other ways that your artistry is going to feed you, literally feed you, put food on the table, and feed your soul.
Yeah, for sure. I love the fact that you were such, like, it's always better when the performers on Broadway and everything are legit theater fans. Like, you know, like, they appreciate it more. They, like, they love it. They love it. And I love it.
I feel like I'm a fan first. And yes, now that I've been doing this for 20 years, I was like, oh, I know what I'm doing. And maybe I can do other things besides act, like direct and produce and whatever. But, like, I also, like, still get geeked out when, you know, the house lights go to half, the house lights go out, the overture starts. Like, I still, to this day, and you would think that I'd be, like, old and jaded and be like, all right. But, like, I don't. Like, I still get just as excited sitting in a theater. The show I saw right before I came to Cape Town, where I'm shooting the show right now, was Strange Loop. And I remember that same anticipation of, like, I know the show just won a Tony. This is the last show I'm going to see before I fly to South Africa for 4 months. Like, I'm so excited. Like, that is the same sort of excitement you get when you're, like, I'm sitting in the front row of the Nederlander Theater. I just slept, like, from 5 a.m. out on the street on 41st Street to get this ticket. I'm so excited to see the show. Like, it's the same. It's still the same.
Now, can I tell you something? Because, like, That shows, like, the fact that, like, what you're saying as a fan and just, like, someone in the theater community, like, it shows because you are always someone whose name pops up when it comes to, like, Broadway events or Broadway giving back or something. Like, you are always, I feel like, at the forefront of those in educating the next generation of Broadway and all those things. Like, you are someone who's always, like, your name is just on that list and you're somehow involved. So I think it shows, and I think that what you do kind of outside of your performing and what you do and every day to just, like, improve the industry in a way and, like, help the industry and support the industry is just it really inspiring for, like, someone like me who is, like, a younger person in the industry, and I guess you could say, like, the next generation, you know? Like, it really gives us a great role model to look up to, and I thank you for that.
Well, that's really sweet of you to say that. You are the next generation, and I am so in many ways, I'm so blown away by your generation and your I don't know, and maybe it was because we all went through a pandemic where everything stopped, not just our industry, yeah, but, like, the world stopped, that your generation is going, okay, well, we stopped. Like, we stopped running around on our hamster wheels. So, like, if we're going to start this hamster wheel again, how do we do it better? Like, how do we do it kinder and smarter? And I feel like your generation is at the forefront of that and pushing the rest of us who are willing to listen, the rest of us who are willing to, like, change, like, you're pushing the rest of us to go, wait a minute, like, this younger generation has it going on. Like, they went through this pause just like we did, but they're coming back wanting to do things in a different way, whereas, you know, somebody like me, I'm 42, like, my muscle memory, my dancer muscle memory is going to say, like, I want it to be the way it was. Well, it never will be the way it was ever again. And in many ways, it shouldn't be the way it was, yeah, you know? So it's a golden opportunity and a golden, I don't know, it's ripe for possibility for all of us to sort of rethink how we come back. But it is your generation. That's, like, teaching us things. So I thank you for saying that, like, I inspire you, but actually, you know, I love to teach and I love working with younger theater artists and talking to younger theater artists for this reason, because I feel like every time I do it, I get something out of it. Like, I feel like just when you think you're so old that you can't learn anything new, you learn it from you. I learn it from you all. So thank you for that.
Hey, we'll take it. We'll take it. But no, you talk about, you know, kind of coming back better and stronger and all these things. And I feel like in those conversations, the most important thing that we need to improve on and that we can still grow in is the representation in the theater. You talked about it, like, going to see Rent and what that did for you. Someone who is inspiring to me and, like, what you do outside of Broadway and as a performer, like, how is it to feel that, like, you are able to do that for a whole community with the AAPI community?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I don't know if I ever thought to be that person to, like, represent an entire community. I think that I think I had to quickly learn that, you know, I could view who I am and that is all of me, right? Like my ethnicity, my skin color, my age, my sexual orientation, the fact that I'm gay, like all of those things, I can either view those things as things that hold me back, right, from this business, or things that propel me forward. There's no changing that about who I am. You know, there's no, all the things I've listed above are not things I can like change about myself, right?
Yeah.
So all I can really do is go, okay, well, I can't change those things. If I could change those things, if I was a different age, ethnicity, sexual orientation, maybe I would get other employment opportunities or other things coming to me, but that's not who I am. Like that's not the life I was given. So I've chosen to see them as assets, and I've chosen to see them as like things that make me unique and special. And I have to say, like, that is something, I don't know if that was something that was as celebrated when I was your age, you know?
Really?
I think that there was an idea when I was coming up and when I was training in theater and, you know, of going, you have to be a certain height and look a certain way, be a certain race, whatever that is, leading men or only blonde-haired, blue-eyed princes, right? Like all of that, the ideas of that, leading ladies only look and sound like this. But I think, if anything, that's changed a lot. You know, our definition of what those things are have changed a lot just by the sheer, just because it changes. That's what art is supposed to do. It's supposed to do that. It's supposed to evolve. It's supposed to change. It's supposed to challenge our ideas of what the world is so that we go, why not? Do you know what I mean? Why not this? Why can't a leading man or a leading lady look like this? Why can't this role be cast with people of a different age or a different gender? Why does it always have to be done this way? And I don't know, like I've always seen myself as somebody who's had to do that for myself. And now that I am in a position where I've done this for a while and I do get to interact with a lot of young artists who want to do this, I encourage the same. Because for me, it's worked for me. But also, in reality, I don't know if I could have done it any other way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I think that was sort of just the way that I was able to find myself. As sometimes people say, well, did you ever feel, like, limited in this business? Did you ever feel, right? And I go, actually, like, I guess I could have felt limited. I could have spent that time and energy and emotional energy to feel like, why didn't I get this part because of all these things I can't control? But I just never, I just chose to do it the other way, which was to just choose to see all of those things that other people might think are restrictive in this business as assets. They're just who I am, you know? And so now I just encourage, now that I get to teach and I get to direct and I get to produce and I get to cast things, like, I go, yes, like, I want to practice what I preach, you know?
Yeah.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUPS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUPS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUPSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Absolutely. And it's interesting that you say that, like, why does it always have to be played this way? Like, my favorite thing to do when I go see theater is, like, something like Company, where it's, like, it was revived, and the role played by a man wasn't played by a man. Like, it was played by a woman, and it, the story was still told, and maybe even improved. And it's, like, the same way with, like, why does it have to be a white person? Like, why does it have to be, like, it's so cool to see the diversity that we are now kind of easing into, I would say, because it's still, we have a lot of ways to go, but easing into on Broadway for sure.
Yeah, you know, the thing is, I think, like, for the theater fans in us, we go, of course, why not? Like, right. Why not this person? Like, why not go see a company that's been gender flipped? And, like, the one I'm the most excited about, I cannot wait to see Lilias White replace Andre DeShields in Hades. Like, but I think it's upon us to go, oh, like, I can't wait to buy a ticket to see that.
Yes.
Because when we buy a ticket to see that, then those people that are producing, those people that are looking at the grosses every week go, guess what? Like, we cast Lilias White in Hadestown, and the ticket sales went like this because everybody, we surprised them. We're giving them something they never thought they'd see. We're like, people want to come back to the show that maybe they've seen before, and now they want to come back, you know? So I don't know. I think I think it works both. I think the way that we're going to get to that is that we actually have to, like, support the shows that do that, right? Like, we have to go out and spend the money on, like, I'm going to go and spend the money on a ticket to Hadestown, even though I've seen it twice, because I want to encourage producers to think like that when they recast a show. You know?
Right. It's totally like you said, our money is our vote. I mean, truly, it's in this industry, that's exactly what it is, especially as like a theater fan, who we all are, and those listening. You mentioned your training earlier. Your training is kind of, I mean, of course, what led you to Broadway, but in a very unique way of like a Broadway legend steering you to a Broadway audition. Tell me about how you got your Broadway debut in the Flower Drum Song.
Yeah, I went to Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, a wonderful musical theater program. It also is, it's the actually the oldest degree in drama in the country, in the United States.
Really?
It's the, yeah.
Wow.
It's the first like college university program to like give a degree in theater.
Wow.
And their musical theater program started in, I think it was 1980, 1981. Rob Marshall was in the first musical theater class of Carnegie Mellon. And they've produced incredible alums since then, right? Like, there was a generation of people. There was the Billy Porter, Michael McElroy, you know, generation. And, you know, then there was the, like, Sutton Foster, Christian Borrell, Patrick Wilson. And then I was sort of there. Like, I was there with, like, Megan Hilty and Leslie Odom and Griffin Matthews and Josh Gad and Gregory Trico and, like, incredible people, right? Like, so it was I was there. It's a great school. My senior year, we were going to do Company as my senior thesis show. And Billy Porter wanted to come back and do some sort of directing project because everybody had known him as an actor. Nobody knew him as somebody who sat behind the table, even though Billy, as we all know now, is a great director and a wonderful writer and a great producer. Like, he wears many hats, right? But he wanted to stretch himself, and he was like, where can I try my hand at directing and do it in a safe space? So he came back to his hometown, Pittsburgh, and he went back to his alma mater, Carnegie Mellon. And I was cast as Bobby in Company. Now, when Billy graduated college in 1991, he graduated college and he went right into the original Broadway cast of Miss Saigon. And when you do Miss Saigon ran on Broadway for over a decade. When you do Miss Saigon, you sort of are initiated into this very lovely, tight-knit group of Broadway Asian actors. There aren't very many of us, but we are a tight-knit group, and we love each other, and we support each other. And when you do Miss Saigon, it doesn't matter what race you are, actually. Like, you get inducted into the, like, Broadway Asian family, right? Because we're spending so many hours at the Broadway Theater together. So, anyway, one of his dear friends was the dance captain of Miss Saigon back in the day, Mark Oka. Mark Oka was going to be the associate choreographer and dance captain on the 2002 revival of Flower Drum Song, a show that Billy Porter saw out of town. It ran at the Center Theater Group in Los Angeles at the Mark Taper Forum. He saw that production, says, it's an amazing production. It's coming to Broadway. And guess what? I have, like, three Asian kids in my cast of Company at Carnegie Mellon that have no agents, no anything, but they need to be seen for this show because it's going to open the fall after they graduate. So he picks up the phone, he calls Mark Oka, and he says, you need to see my students. And we get on a Greyhound bus after tech, rehearsals of companies. He was like, you're playing Bobby. You can't miss any scenes, or you can't miss school. So you have to, like, finish tech at midnight, take the Greyhound bus at midnight. We got off the bus at, like, 9 in the morning, and, like, we went straight to, like, Ripley Greer, and I was at my first Broadway dance audition. And it was a submissions-only audition. So, like, most of the people, everybody else there had, like, agents or were, like, had a Broadway credit. They did Miss Saigon. They did The King and I on Broadway, like, whatever that was. So, like, here we were, the three college kids who just got off a bus. And it was you know, a day of, like, jazz combinations, then cuts, ballet combination, cuts. Then we get to, they go, well, we're going to keep a couple of people to sing. And I see Mark Goka whispering to Bobby Longbottom, the director, next to him. And Bobby Longbottom goes, hey, I hear you're doing Company right now with Billy Porter. I go, yeah, that's what I'm doing in college. He goes, great, sing Being Alive. Do you have Being Alive in your book? And I was like, sure. Yeah, I was like, I just sang it last night at Tech. This is, like, the easiest thing I could do, is sing Being Alive. So that was my audition, was singing Being Alive.
And you booked it.
And that was my first Broadway show. And so I took the Greyhound bus back to Pittsburgh. Now, this is before people had cell phones. This is before, you know.
Oh, yeah.
So, like, I took the bus back, and I saw Billy, and Billy goes, how did you do? And I went, I think I did good. I kept for the jazz combination. I made the ballet combination. They asked me to sing and read, and I sang Being Alive. And he was like, I know how you did. I got a phone call about you already.
He already
got a phone call from Mark saying he did really well, and we're going to call him back for a final callback in the late summer. And I said, listen, Billy, if I get the show, I said, I know I only get 25 words in my playbill, but thank you, Billy Porter, are going to be on my playbill for sure. And on my first playbill on Broadway, you see it's like a teeny tiny bio for, like, you know, ensemble member number 5,
right.
Who's an understudy. But the last 4 words say thank you, Billy Porter, because, you know, he has done that repeatedly for people.
Yeah.
Especially his Carnegie Mellon students, you know, I know for a fact he has picked up the phone and gotten, you know, auditions, or has encouraged, you know, the Leslie Odoms, the Patina Millers, like all of those folks that he had taught when he worked there, you know. He's been such a champion for people. I remember when, like, Billy won a Tony, you know, and, like, when he won the Tony, I think there was a collective, like, jumping up and down of, like, so many people in New York City, because I'm one of many stories of Billy doing that for people, you know?
Absolutely. I'm obsessed with this story, first of all, because I'm actually from Pittsburgh. That's where I'm from, and I started at the Pittsburgh CLO.
Oh, my gosh.
I didn't take the Greyhound to New York, but I took the Megabus first audition. I got it. It was a very popping story. It's so funny how, like, the worlds collide at the CLO and all the things. But love it. So I wanted to ask you, like, in reflecting on what Billy did for you, in a way, I guess, is that why, like, is that in a way why you feel that kind of giving back inspiration? Is that kind of where you get the whole, I want to give back to the next generation, I want to give back to Broadway, I want to give back, like, to that sort of thing?
I think Billy is one of many amazing teachers that have changed my life. So, you know, Billy is certainly one of them, but I have to give it up for all of those incredible professors at Carnegie Mellon, you know, one of them, Claudia Banach, she teaches voice still at Carnegie Mellon, and she, you know, in some ways, like, she became a surrogate mom when I was, like away from home studying. In fact, like, I remember my senior year, I actually got her a Mother's Day gift, like, do you know what I mean? Like, because her office just became everybody's, like, and you can ask everybody who's been a student of hers, they'll say the same thing, you know, they'll go, Claudia Banach was, like, my mom away from mom during the 4 years of college. And then, you know, even in high school, I had incredible, incredible teachers. I went to a math and science high school, and, like, the chorus teacher was somebody, in such an academic place, was somebody who encouraged my musical talents, you know. Her name was Holly Hall. Julie Scheinman was my acting teacher there. She was an English teacher that taught an acting elective, and she coached the speech and debate team. She, like, would volunteer her time to, like, coach me in my Carnegie Mellon monologues, you know. Like, I never did a Shakespeare monologue until I met Julie Scheinman. And then, you know, there were the teachers that, like, volunteered their time, like, after school. Like, Vinnie Grosso, may he rest in peace, he taught mechanical drafting and AV. He taught an AV class, you know, like, film editing. But, like, he would volunteer his time after school so that all of us could, like, put on a show and paint sets and build, like, sew costumes. Do you know what I mean? Like, he didn't get paid for that. Like, he he volunteered to do that, to basically babysit us while we made a show. But, but those were such formative years of my life. It's probably the reason why I do it. So Billy is one of many amazing teachers. And for each teacher I've ever had, there's always like a lifelong lesson that I take away, either as a human being or as an artist, you know. Like Billy, the best lesson Billy ever taught me was about acting, actually. And when you spend 4 years at Carnegie Mellon, you're taught like voice and speech, movement, elocution, all of these things, accents and dialects, how to stand properly, how to speak properly, all of those things. And then Billy was like, guess what? You study 4 years to pick up all of those techniques to then throw it away. So just talk and listen. Just talk and listen is you. And it was wonderful to work on he was like, company's a contemporary, it's not Shakespeare, it's not Chekhov, like this is not heightened text, I need you to speak as you and not act. And it was actually really freeing. And I always say now to my students, I go, listen, acting is the easiest thing in the world because it's just talking and listening, and it's also the hardest thing in the world because it is so hard for us to just talk and just listen, you know?
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah, but he had a huge influence on me for sure.
Yeah. So I'm curious. So the next person I want to bring up, because you did company at Carnegie Mellon and he's another Broadway legend, you got the opportunity to work with Stephen Sondheim in Pacific Overtures.
Yeah.
In that Broadway revival, just a couple of years after you made your Broadway debut. I mean, what was it like to be in a room with him, like the legendary Sondheim?
Yeah. Yeah. There's a great. I remember the first day, well, first of all, my audition process for that show, they had cast that show almost a year in advance because it was in the roundabout season. They knew that they needed an all Asian company. That was at that time still pretty hard to find an all Asian company that could do all of those things, right? That could sing, dance, act, do Sondheim, all of those things. So they had a very extensive search process. I was cast almost a year before the rehearsal started. So I remembered like my first audition was for Paul Gimignani, which is also nerve-wracking in itself because here is Stephen Sondheim's right-hand man, you know, legendary music director. And I dusted off that Being Alive, and that's what I sang again for my audition. And I remember, like, I sort of got a good feeling from Paul. Paul was like, you sound great. He's like, I'm going to give you a tip. He's like, you know, don't really sing until the last chorus. He's like, you can speak the whole first couple of verses, the bridge, you can start to sing a little bit, but don't give me anything fortissimo until the last. Don't really sing to that last one. Save it. You know, and it was a really good note. And I remember saying, oh my gosh, thank you so much for the, I said to him, thank you so much for the in-room audition coaching. And he turns around and he goes, you'll get a bill in the mail from me. And I was like, oh, I like you. Like, you have a good sense of humor. You know what I mean? Because he used that sense of humor to, like, break the ice, basically, which was awesome. And then my final callback was for Stephen Sondheim. And I remembered, like, we had to sing material from the show, and I had to sing There Is No Other Way. And it was – I started singing, and There Is No Other Way. There's, like, a section that is really long – like legato lines. It was like, the bird sings, the wind sighs. This was a lot of like long, spinny vibrato. So I started singing this long, like, the bird sings, the wind. And he goes, stop. And I was like, oh no, he just stopped me in the middle. Like, did I mess it up? Like, did I not? Like, he was like, I don't need to hear anything more. It sounds great. It's gorgeous.
Oh,
and he literally stopped me in the middle because for him, he was like, I got it. I could hear it within the first five bars. I don't need the 16. I don't need the 32 bars. Like, I heard it. Great. So he, like, stopped me in the middle, which was, at first, I was like, oh, gosh, I must have.
Terrifying.
When Stephen Sondheim said, stop. You know what I mean? Like, but also, like, I also was like, if I don't get this job, I'm just going to put It's Gorgeous, Stephen Sondheim, on the top of my resume. Like, it's going to go, like, It's Gorgeous, in quotes, Stephen Sondheim, Tyler Liao, Actors Equity, like, my phone number. You know what I mean? Like, I was like, I'm good.
You can still do it.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, like, working on, you know, in that show, I had to sing Someone in a Tree, which many people, which he has said is one of his favorite songs. And in some ways, like, Someone in a Tree is very much like, you can sort of watch the lineage of, like, Someone in a Tree is like Room Where It Happens from Hamilton. It's like this like cubist painting of, like, you know, this boy in the tree who only sees it but can't hear it, like the samurai underneath who can hear everything that's happening but can't see it, and all of these characters singing in this meta space complete the picture of this memory. And it's one of, he has said, it's one of his favorite things he's ever written. And I remember working on it, and I had to play a little 10-year-old boy. And the way that I did it, there was a lot, I had a lot of, like, I was, like, just a really, like, rambunctious little 10-year-old kid that, like, laughed at everything. Like, and oftentimes I would laugh, and I remembered he taught me a really great lesson. He would go, "Telly, you can laugh here. Don't laugh here. Don't laugh here." He's like, and he would often listen to rehearsals with his eyes closed, and you could tell, like, he was like, "I purposely wrote rest there for a reason. You know, I purposely wrote no music happening, no singing happening here. It's purposeful. That space for and the audience to, like, get it, to not hear anything, to digest what they've heard." And it taught me such a great lesson about, you know, the silences and the pauses and the rests are just as important. And for somebody like Stephen Sondheim, they are just as purposeful and as and need to be valued as heavily as his really smart lyrics. Like, where there's no lyric and it's just underscoring is purposeful. It was a really, really great lesson. He is also one of those people that is so specific about that, and yet for the revival, he, you know, Paul Gemignani would often pick up his cell phone and go, "Do you not like this key? Let me call Steve and let me change it. Let me see if it's okay to change." And, like, oftentimes, like, Steve and Tom would go, "Yeah, whatever key you want it in, I don't care."
Really?
It's fascinating. There were some things that he was so specific about, and then there were some things where he goes, "It's for the sake of this moment and for the sake of the actor, do what's comfortable for the actor." And so, as me, being 24 years old, I just thought, "Oh, Stephen Sondheim, this is like the Bible. Like, we're not allowed to change this, right?" It's like the music theater, like, right? But it's not. For him, he was like, "No, it's, I'm still making theater, and if we're gonna do it again, like, let's do it in a way that's better and kinder and really works for everybody involved, right?" So it was really fun to work on that show with him. For sure.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like walking into a room, like, as a theater kid, as a theater student, like, just having the chance to even meet him, like, would have been, like, just absolutely insane. So I can't imagine what it was like to be able to be in a room with him and really, like, perform his piece for him. Like, I can't imagine walking into the audition and, like, singing a Sondheim song for Sondheim. Like, it would be, like, crazy.
I could tell he really loved that show. I could tell he and Paul Gemignani and John Wyman really, like, had a soft spot in their heart for that show, because often Sondheim would bring, like, friends to come see it, and like, he had house seats. We all knew where Steve's house seats were, and there was. And I remember, like, be like, "Oh, Steve's here again. He's with Hal Prince tonight," or like, "Oh, Steve's here." And, like, one night we were like, "Steve's here," and there's just, like, red hair, and you're like, "Bernadette Peters is here."
Oh my God.
I remember, like, Steve and Bernadette were the last two people to leave the house. They sat in the house and they talked about, I assume they caught up or they talked about the play. And I remembered being like, "I don't want to leave out the stage door. I want to see if I can, like, meet Bernadette Peters."
Right.
So there were, like, three of us that, like, didn't walk out the stage door, but we walked back out into the house. We peeked our head around the curtain, and we were like, "Is that?" And then we slowly, as Bernadette and Steve were, like, walking out, he noticed, like, three Asian actors, like, slowly creeping up behind. And he was so sweet. He was like, "Hi, would you like to meet Bernadette Peters?" Like, he was so nice about knowing how starstruck we were.
That's so sweet. That's so cool. And it's cool to hear that, like, you know, the human aspect of him.
Yeah.
You know, this is that he was, like, a genuinely nice guy, cared about his performers. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so cool. I want to talk to you about Rent, because you mentioned that, like, you know, that was one of those shows that really, like, transformed you, you know? That was one of the shows that you saw, and you were just like, "Oh, my God, maybe I can do this." And you waited in line for the $20 tickets and everything. And it's hilarious, because now you've been in, like, a bajillion productions of the show. So talk to me about, like, what it's like from going I mean, you are a theater fan and you've done it all, but like just being a theater fan and that show specifically and how much that show means to you, then to be able to perform it both on Broadway, on tour, at the Hollywood Bowl, like all these things, talk to me about it.
I've always said if Rent was still running at the Needlelander, I'd still be there.
I'd still be doing it.
Like, I'd still be doing the show because I never got tired of doing the show. And I never, I genuinely love all the people that are in that Rent family. We still very much keep in touch. We, even if we don't talk all the time, we pick up exactly where we leave off. We continue to support one another. It's actually a very tight-knit family, a tight-knit group of people. When we closed on Broadway in 2008, the amazing Crystal Huntington, who is one of the original stage managers from the New York Theater Workshop, she did a whole spreadsheet of every track in the show. So I was Steve and others. So it showed the chronology of Gilles Chasson was Steve and others in the original cast from this date to this date. Then it went like who all the actors that assumed that track, if people left and came back, like who like was there for vacation, like, and then it ended with me. So like you could see the chronology, and when you looked at it, you were like, oh, there haven't been that many people in these.
Really?
If you consider that the show ran for 13 years, why? And you looked at the list, and you were like, those people that like they stayed in the show because they loved doing it, and they loved the people that were in the building. It was hard to leave, you know. And the show gave me great joy every night. I felt like that was one of those shows that I could find something new every night doing it, for sure.
So when you go do this show at the Hollywood Bowl, after you've already done it on Broadway and on tour, and, I mean, Hollywood Bowl production was, like, insane. Directed by Neil Patrick Harris, Vanessa Hudgens started it, Skylar Astin, Wayne Brady, like, all these, like, all these incredible people were in it. You're a veteran of the show. Like, what is that experience like for you? Is it like learning still because you have new scene partners? What is that?
Yeah, the being a veteran of the show was actually purposeful because Neil Patrick Harris had all of 10 days to direct the show.
Oh, really?
Now, he knew that he definitely wanted new people to be brought into the Rent family, especially because it's the Hollywood Bowl. They have to have some sort of Hollywood cachet, right? So, like, he knew he wanted people that had never worked on the show before to be able to work on it, on this particular version of it. So he purposely said, I'm going to, like, have Skylar and Vanessa, who are new to the show, be Mark and Mimi, but Aaron Tveit was always his first job, I think, was in the non-equity tour of Rent covering Mark and Roger. So Aaron was there to be like, hey guys, like he was the shorthand.
Wow.
Like Tracy Toms, who had done every single version of Rent ever, right? Like she was the one, Nicole was with Nicole Scherzinger, who'd never done Rent. And Wayne, same thing, Wayne Brady, never done Rent. Wayne was also very busy shooting Let's Make a Deal. Neil was like, I need somebody who's going to be like with Wayne that's like solid, knows the show really well. So he purposely sort of designed the duos and the couples to all be folks that had like that had never done it, and then folks that knew the show in and out. And it ended up being useful for the rehearsal process of it all. But the Hollywood Bowl is like a dream, for sure a dream. Like it's a wild experience to perform there. You know, we had to make cuts for the show because the Hollywood Bowl has a curfew. I don't know if you know this, but the people that live around the Hollywood Bowl like have said, oh, like nothing can go past 11. So we had to make certain little cuts here and there to like shorten the show, to fit the intermission in, all of that. You can't really feel the cuts. Like Neil did a great job with it, with Tim Weil, who was the original music supervisor, made some really smart cuts into it. But it was a wild experience and a great company. It was only a weekend. It was 3 days, you know?
Right. I mean, you can't beat that, right?
Yeah. Jamal Sims was a choreographer. That was really fun to work with. Like, Jamal Sims, incredible. You know, we see him on RuPaul's Drag Race all the time now. But, like, he was a wonderful choreographer to work with on the show. And for Neil, I think it meant a lot for him to do it because he's in the Rent family. He was Mark on the first National, you know, so he knew the show in and out, and it had a really special place for him, you know. So, I felt really lucky to be a part of it.
Yeah, and it's cool, too, because, like, it's a testament, again, of, like, you know, Neil can bring these people back, but it has to be those people that have to say, yes, I want to do the show again. Of like, you know, they really don't want to leave that show. You know, so many people came back to be able to perform it again, even if it was just for a weekend, you know?
Yeah.
That's so cool.
I'm going to get a chance to direct the show next year. I'm doing it at UC Irvine. I'm going to be directing it, and my choreographer from Allegiance, Andrew Palermo, is going to be choreographing it. And it's a university production at UC Irvine. But again, like, you know, directing is new for me, so I try to find safe spaces for me to take risks and stretch myself as an artist and as a director. And so I said, you know what, like, I'm still new at this, but I definitely want to be able to, like, discover the show again with these students, and also like give them my experience from the show too, and like I'm very excited to be able to like reimagine the show a little bit for a 2022 audience with people, you know, with people who are 20, 21, you know.
Yeah. Oh my God, I want to go see it. Really? Oh my God, that'd be so cool. You just talked about Allegiance. I mean, I know that's a show that means a lot to you. I want to ask you about that. I mean, similar to, like, Sondheim, like, performing his work and everything, like, George Takei, he lived this story. He lived it. So, like, I can't imagine what it was like to be able to go into a room with him and really be his scene partner as he, like, relived these experiences, and maybe even, like, you talk to him as, like, research for the role and your story and everything. What was the act?
He, you know, it was inspired by his life. It was also inspired by so many of the unheard stories and the stories that we still don't, you know, that are still not widely known about the Japanese American internment. I think when it's a part of American history that a lot of people don't know about, maybe more people know about it now because of Allegiance and because of George, because of his work talking about it, right? But I think that for many of the Japanese Americans that had family that lived it, there was a certain amount of like shame and also a desire to like move on from it. Yeah. So when the internment ended, a lot of those people that were interned were like, we're moving on, we're not talking about that time. So some of those stories were even lost or buried in an effort, because either they felt ashamed of the experience, or they just wanted to be able to go, that was 3-4 years of my life that we're not going to get back, that were really dark, and we're going to like move on and on to the next, right? So for pure survival, people wanted to move on, and so for that reason, a lot of those stories are lost, and yet it's this chapter of American history that we can learn so much from. You know, it's one of the few times in America Reagan actually, like, gave an official apology from the American government. It happened in the 80s. I mean, it was about 40 years too late. But, like, you know, it's one of those things that is, you know, it's a flaw. It was something we did that was an egregious mistake and an egregious infringement on Americans' rights.
Absolutely.
And we should and can learn from it. So for George, this has always been something that has been really important to him, making sure that this story gets out. You know, he was interned when he was a little kid. Yeah. And ever since he was a little kid, he and his family have been treated like second-class citizens. And he has always said that his work, being somebody who, you know, stands up and fights for LGBTQ rights, stands for AAPI rights, like, it all stems from that. It actually stems from that experience of him and his family feeling like they were in a country that said liberty and justice for all, that's the promise of this country, and yet that's not how they were treated. Mm-hmm. And that he's always sort of fought for equality because of that, you know? And I think doing the show and working on the show, and we developed the show from, like, I was attached to it from 2009 till we opened on Broadway in 2015. And working on the show and having so many great conversations with him about that story, about the impact of that story, about how hard it is to tell that story, you know, what it costs to tell that story, what that event actually, like we do in the show, that event actually did break up families, you know, like, so it was important for us to get it right, you know, and I think with George, we, I felt really good about getting it right.
Yeah, I mean, that cast of George and Leah and you, and like, it's incredible. I'm so mad that I didn't get to see it, but I actually did. For those of you listening, if you didn't get to see it on Broadway, I did get to see it on Broadway HD,
which is
still available on it. So it's 100% worth the watch. It's like, it's a lot. It like, you have to prepare for it, but it's incredible.
I mean, thank goodness for Broadway HD.
Facts. Oh, my God.
Because the show only ran 4 months on Broadway. And listen, I was very proud of, like, the show and how it did. You know, it opened the same season as Hamilton. The only two shows to survive that season were Hamilton and Waitress. Like, everything else closed that season. So of course, like, and always, like, from the very beginning, you know, I remember when Leia and I first worked on the show, it was like, we said, oh, I don't know, a musical about the Japanese-American internment, like, this is going to be, it's not something that screams Broadway hit, like, musical, but it doesn't mean it's not important to tell the story. And, you know, it's not something that people go, okay, like, we're going to do the music of this rock star's catalog. You're like, okay, great. Like, there's a built-in fan base for that. Like, this is a tough subject matter, right?
Right.
So we always walked into it going, gosh, like, we could run 4 days, 4 weeks, 4 months, who knows, 4 years. Let's just make the most out of it, you know, that the people that do get to see it, let's try to give them a story that they've not heard. Let's move them. Let's hope that they see our show and that they exit the theater seeing the world differently. And I'm so glad that our producer, yeah, Lorenzo Tioni, was like, listen, we only ran 4 months on Broadway, but let's film it and make sure that future generations, like, you know, can watch the show, can hear this story. And I'm getting all of these folks that say, I watched it in musical theater history class, but I'm also getting all these folks that are saying, we watched it in American history class. Like, unrelated to theater, they're watching Allegiance to learn about World War II and the Japanese-American internment. I was like, great. That's so we did our job. Yeah.
Yeah, I love that because I feel like I maybe learned about it for, like, not even, like, a half day, you know, right, in history class. Like, you know, it's one of those things that now I've had to, like, in my later years, look up, you know, to learn about or watch it through Allegiance. Like, it's crazy. Like,
well, it was also brought up by, you know, with Donald Trump recently being president,
right,
and him suggesting that we go back to the time of rounding people up and putting them in internment camps. You're like, wait a minute, like, we did that already. Like, we're not doing that again. Like, do you know what I mean? So, you know, I think it's sort of gained a different relevance politically in our world outside of theater.
Totally. Totally. I don't want to keep you too long. So I do want to talk to you about your current show that you're talking. I mean, we haven't even talked about Aladdin and Transit, all the things. But your resume is just incredible, and your experience is your brain. It's like, I just want to talk to you all day. It's amazing. But currently, you mentioned that you're filming a TV series for HBO Max. It's called Warrior. What are you allowed to talk about?
Yes, Warrior is a show that takes place in the late 1800s in San Francisco. There was a lot of Irish immigration there, and also a lot of Chinese immigrants had settled in San Francisco Chinatown. So the series takes place San Francisco Chinatown, late 1800s, and I play a nomadic Chinese singer who travels the world singing for my supper, and I happen to land in San Francisco singing gigs. I know it's, I remembered, like, this was one of those auditions. I did a self tape for this audition, and I remembered reading the description, which was like, gay Chinese singer who travels the world singing for his supper. I said, that's me. That is me. That is basically what I do, is I pack my bags, I get on a plane. Where's the gig? When is soundcheck? Let's do the concert, right? Like, that is, like, that's, so it's interesting. I was like, I read the character description, and I said, oh, this is very much me, no acting required. And so I was thrilled that they said, hey, they cast me, and we are now here filming for in Cape Town, South Africa, for 4 months. And I've never been to South Africa. It's a beautiful place. Cape Town is a gorgeous place. It's a beautiful place with a very complex and complicated history. So it's been fascinating to be here, and to work with incredible, the cast is from all over the world. Like, It's a global show. So some of the we have incredible actors from Canada and Indonesia and Hong Kong and local Cape Town actors, a lot of UK actors, it's Australians. You know, it's such a wonderful international company. It's been a joy to work on it.
Oh, my God. So cool. And by the way, for those listening, if you aren't already watching it, there are two seasons out. So he's going to be in season 3, which is so exciting. So go check that out on HBO Max. It's brilliant. One last question for you. I want to ask you, and I'll let you go. After being in this industry for so long, what is like your biggest takeaway that you've learned about the industry itself? Like from a performance, a business, whatever kind of perspective that you want to look at it from. And like, I guess it's kind of like a, what did you wish, like, CMU Telly knew?
Yeah, for me, in my 20s, all I wanted to do was perform. All I wanted to do was, like, get on a stage, perform. You know, I think we all have those dreams of, like, I want to sing and dance on Broadway. And that dream happened for me really quick. You know? It happened right when I, thanks to Billy Porter, I graduated college and, like, I went right into a Broadway show. My Broadway show then opened and closed 4 months later, and I was pounding pavement, like trying to find my next show. And over the years, of course, like your 20s, I spent so much of my 20s just like going show to show to show and just wanting to perform more and more. And as I did that in my 20s more and more, whether that was on Broadway or regionally or television, whatever that was, like I realized in my 30s, oh gosh, what keeps me doing this? Because it's hard. This is hard to do. Like, you know, I always say to my students, like, you know, you read my playbill and you go, oh my gosh, Telly's had such an incredible career. Look at all the credits. I go, yeah, but for every credit, there's 100 jobs I didn't get. Because nobody writes in a playbill bio all the jobs that they auditioned for that they didn't get and how many hours they feel disappointed by all of those things and how you have to, like, keep going, actually, till the next thing comes along, right? So, like, I was like, what, in my 30s, when I was like, do I quit? Like, what do I do? Like, do I keep doing this? I said, what's keeping me in it? It's the people. Mm-hmm. And it's really, it's being, and I think back to like why I did it and why I started doing it in high school in the first place. Mm-hmm. And it was because I realized that going to rehearsals for my musical after school, the thing I wasn't getting a grade in, the thing that like Vinny Grasso, who taught drafting, was volunteering his time to like allow us to do, it was my safe space. It was my tribe. It was the one place where everybody's welcome. Do you know what I mean? Like, and you don't have to have talent to work in theater. You just have to have the will to be there and the will to work with other people. So like, you can't sing and dance, great, pick up a paintbrush, go paint that set, but you're part of something bigger than you. You're part of something that wouldn't have existed if these people don't come together. And I realized in my 30s, I was, and now into my 40s, I go, that's why we do this, because the theater is a microcosm for the way that the world can be. If we all sort of like got together and picked up a paintbrush and painted a set and treated the world like we did after school theater, the world would be a better place. Right. And sort of being a part of that, whatever part that is, whether it's I continue to act, I continue to perform, or I direct, or I produce and I bring those people together, or I teach the next generation, whatever that is, if I can contribute to this art form, I believe this art form will create better people.
Yes,
I really do. I really think that, like, the people that do theater, there is something we understand about humanity and collaboration, what it is to talk and listen and work with other people, that is the magic sauce and the solution to this world being a better place.
Absolutely. I cannot agree with you more. That's amazing. I mean, truly. I mean, the way that artists just work in general, I feel like they just have such a their mind in a way is like a canvas. Like it's an open canvas and we paint it along the way through our experiences that we grow up in. And I can agree with you more. Like I feel like we're open-minded more. We're definitely more inclusive.
Yeah.
And all that. So Telly, I can't thank you enough for lending me your time and your wonderful knowledge about the industry and your career. Talking to you about your career is absolutely fascinating, and so I know people are going to enjoy it. So thank you so much for this.
Eli, thank you for this. This was so fun. Thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you. Take a Bow, Telly Leung. Oh my God. Just listening to him and listening to his experience of working with Sondheim and working with, you know, all these incredible people like Billy Porter and these Broadway legends that had had such an impact on his career and the way that he likes to give back to the next generation of Broadway folks and performers and all the things. Like, it's just so cool. And just to see what he does for the Broadway community from a fan perspective, he really takes the time out to give some advice and kind of be there. Like I said, he's always at Broadway Con. He's always at these events. He's always at the Schubert Alley events with Broadway Barks or Broadway Flea Market or any of those things, he's there. So it's just really cool to see him giving back, and it's so cool to see all of his success in the industry that he's had. And now he's, you know, kind of going into the directing round and all the things. He said he would definitely continue performing and all the things. I mean, as you heard, if Rent came back to Broadway, he'd be in it tomorrow. So if they casted him, of course. So it's just great to talk to him about it all and to really learn about, you know, kind of get an inside scoop of Sondheim and get an inside scoop of Billy Porter. And yeah, it's just, it's really cool to hear. And I hope that you enjoyed those stories. I hope you enjoyed his insight of like the college audition process and what it's like to go to a performing arts theater and the advice that Billy Porter gave him. Like, he shared his advice that kind of changed his life and his career. So hopefully you all really took that in and can use that in your career and your everyday life. So yeah, that's this week's episode of Take a Bow. 118 is in the book. And yeah, I can't thank you all for listening, and I hope to see you next week. Bye, everyone. Have a great week. For this episode's curtain call, I would like to recognize a few people who also deserve to take a bow. This podcast would not be possible without the help from Dori Berenstein, Brittany Bigelow, Katie Rosen, Alan Fields, and the team at the Broadway Podcast Network. Next in line to take a bow is Ketchy Tokash, who edits the audio and all the visuals for this podcast. A special thanks to patrons Brian Thompson, Pat McNamara, the listeners at PPC, as well as all the other patrons for their continued support. If you're interested in becoming a patron, go to patreon.com/TAB. And if you enjoyed this week's episode, don't forget to subscribe on the platform that you're currently listening to this on. Also, feel free to give us a follow on Instagram at Take a Bow Podcast. Take a Bow's logo is designed by Giselle Bustos, and the music is by Nikki Torsha and McCormick Collinon. Bye, everyone. Hope to see you next week.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.
If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah,
not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.